This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the Library Science Channel of New Books Network. My name is Jen Hoyer, and today I'm speaking with Anne Bayo, the author of From Handwriting to Footprinting, Text and Heritage in the Age of Climate Crisis. From Handwriting to Footprinting was published by Open Book Publishers in 2023. How do we currently preserve and access texts, and will our current methods be sustainable in the future? In From Handwriting to Footprinting, Anne Bayo seeks to answer this question by offering a detailed analysis of the methods that enable access to textual materials, in particular access to books of literary significance. This book provides an overview of the changing boundaries of access to literary heritage over centuries, deconstructing the Western tradition of archiving and how it has led to current digital dissemination practices. Rigorously examining the negative environmental impact of digital publishing and archiving, Bayo proposes an alternative model of preservation and dissemination, which reconciles fundamental traditions with the value of social responsibility and sustainability in an era of climate crisis. Anne Bayo is professor of German studies with a focus on digital humanities at Le Mans Université. Anne, welcome to New Books Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Before we get started talking about your book, would you mind introducing yourself to listeners? I would love if you could share a little bit about where you grew up, what kind of path your education took, and what brought you to the work that you're doing now.
Yeah, well, thanks for asking that. It's really part of the whole story of the book, so it's nice. I was born in France, and I went to school in France, and I started to learn German at school when I was like 12 or 13, and discovered that I really love languages in general at that point. And that's also the time when I started to gather old family papers and started writing myself. When I then evolved and started to consider what I would study, what I really wanted to do was keep studying all aspects of text dissemination, everything that has to do with language, with literature, with history and philosophy. And that's why, being in France, I decided to study German studies, because when you're in this other language area, you get the whole package of like language, literature, history, etc. And that's during my studying time, where I had my first longer stays in Germany. And after I completed my PhD, I stayed in Germany for 15 years, especially because I was lucky enough to have the opportunity to have my own research group. It was funded by the German Research Foundation for 6 years, and the whole group worked on intellectual networks in Berlin in the late 18th, early 19th century. And with that grant from the German Funding Foundation, I had a group of 7 people, and we worked on archival material. And that's also the moment where, with the whole group, I moved to working in a very traditional way with archival material, to using digital methods to publish this archival material. So that's the point where I started to work on my digital edition, Letters and Texts, Intellectual Berlin around 1800, which was really seminal for what came after that. In that edition, it's a digital scholarly edition in which I decided with my group to really break the boundaries of canon-based editorial approaches of literature with this idea that you can put letters, which are minor genre, at the same level as literary texts in themselves, and to see how by considering these types or these genres of text as equivalent or as having a similar value, you can get more out of both the letters and the text themselves. And the big difference also between this digital scholarly edition and the way I had worked before is that it was fully open access, really reachable without any barrier, without having to pay for anything. It's just if you have the link, you get on the page. And I had that feeling that I could reach the whole world with my work, which was really making things very different from working in a very niche field, actually, basically. I then went back to France for my habilitation thesis, that's very French, and reached in an analysis on the relationships between publishers and writers from the late 19th to the early 20th century. That's one part of the habilitation, and the other part was a more theoretical work on archives in the digital age. And based on this habilitation, I got my current professorship for German studies with a focus on digital humanities, and that's the position I have since 2017. The climate-related aspects of my work have been a growing focus of my interest since COVID. Actually, I think COVID was a time where many of us like reassessed our focus of interests. So that's the moment for me where I started like to taking this more into account in my work. I joined French research networks working on this question of the impact of the climate crisis. And in these networks, I received training and I have colleagues from various disciplines I can talk to. And based on that, I initiated several working groups myself in Germany and more globally. And now I'm working on training schemes for humanities researchers and heritage professionals in order to strengthen this focus on the impact of the climate crisis on the way we work, both in the humanities and in heritage institutions.
Fantastic, thank you. And I can see like how all of those threads come together in this book. And especially I love that you mentioned your childhood fascination with old papers. Maybe that will come up again in our conversation. So turning then to this book, from handwriting to footprinting, could you talk a little bit more about how the book came to be and what some of your hopes and goals were for this project?
So when I started considering writing a book, it had to do with the fact that most of my publications, since I'm working in France, but in German studies, most of my publications are in German or in French, and I have a split readership, which is also very limited, actually, if you consider them separately. I've been wanting to publish more in English for a long time, and the idea to write a book in English was really to expand a bit my existing scholarly readership, but also to go beyond scholarly readership and reach a wider audience. My habilitation thesis, which I just mentioned, was like half in German and the other half in French. And my idea was really to present a synthesis of all of that, which is actually putting together the last 25 years of my work. And the idea was really to do that in an accessible manner, which is why I chose to publish it with Open Book Publishers, which is fully open access. Also, it was also a choice to limit the amount of footnotes. I'm not usually writing in such a light way somehow, and to have a rather short book in an accessible language, that really was important for me, and focusing also on the lessons learned along the way over the past 20-25 years, to reflect on the two major shifts which I have been experiencing in my scholarly practice, which is one, the shift to digital media, and the second would be realizing the impact the climate crisis has on my scholarly practice. So my goal with this book is really to show how these shifts change the way we consider texts, especially literary texts, and the way in which these shifts will have a lasting impact on heritage strategies, the strategies we have as a society in the global north. There's also, I think, in writing this book, a dimension of education to digital literacy, because talking to my students, talking also to my colleagues from the humanities, I have the sense that they're still very much unaware of the connections between traditional theoretical approaches of archiving, of editing, of publishing, and the empowerment that is brought about on the one hand by technologies, and on the other hand by, let's say, eco-feminist approaches that criticize technologies in a fruitful manner. So this book was really composed of rearranged parts of my habilitation thesis and a more experimental part on basically how can we proceed from here, considering the constraints of the climate and biodiversity crisis.
Yeah. Well, so let's start with talking about the first section. Overall in the book, you're talking about these like core cultural and scholarly practices for making text available so that you can explore how the transition to digital raises questions about environmental impact. And in the first chapter, you look at the process and practice of archiving. How do you understand the ways archives shape the dissemination of texts? And then how do you see archival practices changing through the 20th century to account for more complex media and for the shifting sociocultural relevance of archiving?
So when we talk about archives in general, it can actually mean three different things. It can mean the collection of old papers themselves. It can mean the institution that hosts these collections. And it can mean the building that hosts the institution. So archives are all of that in one. And their role is to collect papers and to make them accessible for later consultation. And that involves a series of steps that actually do shape the dissemination of the text they keep. One very important aspect of this dissemination process is selection. So the general idea of archiving is that you know from the onset that you will not be able to or not even want to keep everything. There will be some sorting, selecting, and some elements that will be discarded. For instance, some archives, their goal, their mission is to keep legal material, and that's the only thing they will have. Others will have only administrative documents, and others will have literary texts, for instance, literary texts from one specific author. So this dimension of selection is important because it's really at the core of the archiving process, and it's something that we can still find today. It's really an important thread to understand how the way we can envision archiving today relates to the way archiving has always worked. There's another point that is really important to understand how archiving really shapes the dissemination of text is the way it offers a form of organization. You need to have a system to find what you are looking for in an archive. It's this systematic organization that is at the core also of archival techniques. So recording principles, recording techniques mean concretely that, for instance, the description of the content is important, the folder names are important, the numbering is important, and all these techniques are there to facilitate the retrieval of information. And they have been in use for a very long time. You have archives in Athens, for instance, in the 5th century before Christ. And these techniques, they not only have been in use for a long time, they also have been improved with time. So to come back to your second question, how archival practices change in the 20th century and shift somehow the sociocultural relevance of archiving. In fact, I think we could say that digital media make the potential dissemination power of these archiving techniques even greater. Because digital archiving methods make the archiving steps more transparent. They make the articulation between data and metadata, this old description of contents that are so essential to recording, they make this articulation much clearer, much more transparent, and they also make much more transparent the identification of the iterations of a text, so the different versions you can have of a text. The core philosophy of digital long-term accessibility builds technologies on top of centuries of archival practices and theories. And it's also a way of understanding better what text is by looking at the way digital media work with it. So if I take the example of literary texts, which are a very special case, very special types of archive, but also very representative of what the point I'm trying to make here. So the political and sociocultural relevance of literary texts has emerged with the rise of nations, mostly in the 19th century in Europe. And at that point, the archiving strategies were really embedded in structures of power. And this precisely shows the importance of displaying authority on a text. And that's what the way literary archives were constructed a long time also shows. So for instance, if you know only one German author, you probably know Goethe. And the way he envisioned his own personal archive is very interesting, because at the end of his life, so he lived for a long time for considering the period when he has been living. And when he grew older, he started preparing two things. One was the final edition of his oeuvre, so all of his works, and an archive of his life and work. And he did that with the help of several secretaries. So he had gathered all of his papers. He had retrieved some papers, for instance, letters he had sent to other people. He asked the other people to send the letters back to get everything together. So he had put everything in one room and tried sorting it, and his secretaries would then proceed to the recording. And there is this notion in the way he tried to set up the archive of his life and work that controlling all these layers of text that was written by his hands would be a powerful tool to ensure his everlasting canonization somehow. So the argument he was making at this point to justify all the effort that was put into this archive of his work is that he always keeps saying that he owed it to the nation. So there's really this strong political link to the structures of power at a more general level. And this archive that Goethe set up of his own life and work is the basis for what will then become the first German literary archive ever founded at the end of the 19th century, so that's the Goethe and Schiller Archiv in Weimar. And it's really a good example of the way authors can consider the importance of the archiving step in building their own oeuvre. So one key element is for understanding how archive shape the dissemination of texts, that's the fact that basically, as I said at the beginning, selection is important and destruction will be part of the archiving process. And that is true for analog and for digital archiving. So whatever the media, we will not be able to keep everything. We will have to make choices. We have always had to. And just the same, we can't keep all the versions of all texts. And this idea that understanding how we select, why we select, and for what we select, why we are archiving, is really fundamental to understand also the missions of archivists in general and all these archiving processes more generally.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really glad that you described all of these ways that we can see archives giving power and authority, because that was something that came through really strongly for me in your writing, and I was really glad that you were so clear about that. And you've also mentioned, you know, that selection is always part of the work in an archive, and I wonder if you'd like to share that anecdote that you share near the beginning of the book about finding some of your own papers and bringing them to an archive. What was that experience, and how did that start your thinking around archives?
So that's really it all started when I was rather young, and I was really enthusiastic because we had this old family home, and I at first my great grand aunt was showing me these papers, and at some point there was a box and she didn't even know what was in there. So I opened the box and I realized, wow, these papers, they're like from another century, like the 19th century. And okay, it was not particularly interesting in content. It was just ledgers and school notes, etc. But I thought, it's so old, it's probably very interesting, and we have to keep that. So I brought these documents to the local archive, and what they said was that the documents were actually not old enough to be of relevance, and not old and or original enough. So actually, I brought the box back home, and I still have the box at home. Although probably in the meantime, they might be considered old enough to be worth keeping at the local archive.
Yeah, that's so funny because, I mean, as you point out, every archive wants something different, and what is old enough for one archive might not be old enough for another, and all of that changes as I'm sure we'll get into talking more about digital things. All of that changes also when we're looking at archiving things digitally. But shifting to the second chapter, this is where you explore the work that publishing does to disseminate texts. Again, from the analog past to the digital present. So, who has historically been involved in that process, and how did the relationship between authors and publishers shift as we move into a digital age?
So the goal of publishing is rather different from the goal of archiving, because the goal of publishing is to disseminate numerous copies of the same text, while in an archive, generally, it's like one original document that you want to keep in one place in order not to lose it, so to speak. So the idea is for publishing is that it's about disseminating numerous copies of the same text via their mechanical reproduction, or the mechanical reproduction of its content. And the goal is also, which is quite different from archive in general, to make money out of it. So the way it works now appeared in the modern era. In the pre-modern era, it was a bit different. In the pre-modern era, basically, printers would receive printing jobs from writers who were mostly working for a patron. And then, so the patron was paying for the work, and then the printers printed it, and the booksellers would sell the printed copies. And when this business shifted from barter trade to a money-based trade, that's the point where new professions emerged. So the first one was the publisher as a profession. And so that profession appeared at the end of the 18th century, and the idea is that a publisher is somehow an investor who is facilitating access to printing and bookselling structures for writers. And this the these publisher figures, they became powerful quite quickly, actually, the late 18th, early 19th century. And at the same time, writers started emancipating from these patronage structures and to become more autonomous, and wanting really to also not depend on a patron or another structure, and try to really leave from what they were writing. So in the early 19th century, you have two new professions emerging. On the one hand, publishers, and on the other hand, writers who really want to be considered as writers, like professionally. And in the early 19th century, publications were really common endeavors of publishers on the one hand and writers on the other hand, and both had strong financial and emotional interests in these texts that they were publishing together. And basically, this is exactly the tension that was at play, trying to find a way to articulate the identification of both publishers and writers with the text. Also, in the sense that both of them actually shape the text. They really work together on the wording, on the way the text looks like on a page, on size of volume, the fonts that will be chosen, etc. So they really shape the text together, and they decide together on the dissemination. So you will find, for instance, a lot of letters of authors who would complain that publishers have done a sloppy job on their text and have introduced mistakes, because they consider that they should still have the only authority and the publisher is just there as an investor. So there's sometimes also a bit of a misunderstanding, let's say, between the missions of the two people involved in shaping this text. So if I take again the example of Goethe, it's really quite interesting because he had a very special relationship to his publishers, and one that also shows how this is also a place where you could exert some sort of control on text and text dissemination. So when Goethe was young, he experienced some bitter disappointments because some publishers refused the manuscript, and other publishers made an unauthorized version of another manuscript of his or book of his. So when he became very famous, he decided, which happened like practically from one day to the next, he decided to always do three things with publishers. So the first one is he would always have a third person, another one, negotiating for him with the publisher. He would never do it by himself. Second, he would always engage with the publisher without even showing the manuscript. So the publisher had to say yes or no without seeing the manuscript. And third, he would let the publisher suggest the price. And that was a way to make sure that his work was properly valued. And that's, he's the only one who has done that. And somehow it is also, it shows how he had this sense of the strong authority that the writer, the author should have compared to the role of the publisher. And actually even Schiller, who was his friend, said that he was impossible when it comes to publishing deals. So Schiller had been warning publishers. And so I've been working a lot on that period of the early 19th century, which is interesting because it's really a period in continental history. It's a bit different in the UK, where copyright wasn't properly established. And it's interesting because this lack of regulation shows very clearly where the tensions are and where the interests might be diverging from one another. Also, it's interesting because it's challenging for historians of literature or historians of text in general to transmit this multiplicity of hands that are at work on the printed texts, and sometimes in a kind of wild but arcane fight for authority. And these working on this, also on the difference between, for instance, the manuscript of one text and the printed version, the published version of one text, also raises the question of the editorial responsibility, our editorial responsibility, for instance, today. For instance, when we work on texts and constitute them and present them as an oeuvre, for instance. So there's we are shaping it also in some way. So that's basically what it looked like in this modern era before copyright became regulated. And if I jump then a few centuries later, so really a lot of centuries, sometime later, to the modern, to the current period. So when you try to gain orientation, for instance, in digital publications, there's some kind of sense of lost authority, like, if anyone can publish anything, how can I know that something has editorial value in online publications? And that shows that publishers still play a key role today, because they are somehow also a way to assess the value of a text or a publication. And that's true for better and for worse, actually, because the consequence of that is that big tech companies still widely influence, for instance, the discoverability of publications based basically on their own financial interests, for instance, by developing algorithms based on consumer profiles. So that's the completely opposite. And in that sense, and that's also why I've been trying to argue in favor of the open source and open access community, is because this is really a community that makes an effort to counterbalance this domination mechanism and to make way for a more distributed way view of authority in the assessment of text. So the open source and open access community has been striving to develop quality criteria for digital text especially. And also the idea is to empower readers. Sometimes also to maybe empower readers with more tools than they actually can master, which is also a problem. Like sometimes I tell my students, okay, well, you can just use this and do that, and they're completely overwhelmed and it's not helping them either. So there's also some, it's not that simple somehow to assess the value of digital publications and also to bring people to be able to do that on their own. But what I think is, and what I've been trying to argue in the text, in the book, is that there really is a common effort of the scholarly community and of heritage institutions to offer iterative and distributed approaches of quality texts. For instance, there's more and more citizen science experiments trying to bring readership and audiences to contribute. And by contributing, also people get familiar with the way it works, with the way quality criteria work. For instance, for my students, I always try to convince them it's worth trying to edit Wikipedia articles, because then you get to understand how it actually works. Yes, so it's not really easy to gain orientation in the digital world when it comes to publications. And I must say, and it's very different in the European context and in the US context, because there are very strong political efforts in the EU to strengthen the Open Access Initiative, and also in particular to establish something like cultural commons, and heritage is considered a common good in some way. And in that context, digital media has been instrumental in making a wide array of textual material available to a wide array of the population. So really, digital media has made access to text, and especially access to quality text, possible, and has provided means to address preservation strategies on a wide social basis. And that is really now possible, and it was not before the advent of digital tools.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the way we see these threads of power and authority coming through again in the second chapter, in these two avenues of archiving and publishing. And it's so interesting to reflect on how everything is different, but also the same when we get into digital contexts. And so the third chapter of your book really focuses on digital, and you explore a number of social, economic, and environmental costs of increasing the circulation of texts. How should our current system for disseminating text through archives and through publishing account for and be shaped by environmental issues?
Yeah, so I've been talking about quality text before because I wanted really to balance the fact that actually what one mostly sees when it comes to digital media is the increase in the quantity of textual information that circulates, and that makes it sometimes difficult to gain orientation and sometimes difficult also to escape the grasp of big tech companies. But I would still argue that digital media is an overall improvement, that comes at a cost, like you said, a different level. So one is that there is still a very big divide in access to information in general between the global South and the global North, for a series of reasons. Another cost concerns the fact that there are very different regulation forms, like I said, between Europe and the US, for instance, and that means that most of the users of the internet pay somehow for access to text with personal data. So the price is not just money, it's also privacy. And using digital media, like any activity, like any human activity, has an environmental impact, which is can be measured in a variety of ways. So it can be measured in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, for instance, but it can also be measured in terms of other forms of impact, impact on biodiversity, impact on water resources. When we think of, for instance, books, that can also be impact on wood resources to produce paper. So what we see in the current archiving and publishing strategies is that usually they don't really account for their environmental impact. The other aspects are mostly taken into account, but this one, or people try to take them into account, but the environmental impact is really almost not considered. In the heritage world, so GLAM institutions, for instance, you can see already that there is an effort to measure this impact. But the sole effort of measuring the impact is nascent. And we don't have frameworks, we don't have standards, we don't have workflows that would account for it. And that makes it really difficult, actually. Even if you're realizing that this is an issue, what do we do? So how can you do anything about it? So that's what happened to me with my digital edition of Letters and Texts Intellectual Berlin around 1800. I have been working for 10 years to provide a quality edition according to philological standards and according to digital standards. So basically, that's very complex digital philology work. And really, all the time, I was motivated by the idea that I would provide access to a wide array of people and that I would improve knowledge and culture at large, globally, etc. And there was this moment of awakening when I realized first that not everybody can access my digital edition, because if you have slow internet, if you have an older computer, you can't really cope with the quantity of information that is displayed on a standard web page, basically. And second, because all of these technical requirements, like, for instance, making the digital scholarly edition accessible 24/7, has a high environmental impact. So basically, those people who can't access my digital edition, people basically from the global south, they also pay the higher environmental price for it because they're the first ones to be impacted by the climate crisis. So that was really a moment where I've been thinking, okay, so what I've been doing was the exact opposite of what I was trying to do. I think in these approaches of questions related to environmental impact, awareness is really key. It's really the first step. So the idea that, okay, you start seeing things through this lens and then everything looks different. And often this awareness is really not part of the conception and realization of digital services at this point. And that really should change, I think. So when you start considering these questions of environmental footprint or impact, the second step after becoming aware of it would be to identify the elements that you need to account for in your, let's say, environmental budget. So what will count? What will have a footprint? So generally, considering now what I've been talking about, anything that allows to have access to text, like archiving, publishing, editing, these elements of the environmental budget would be, for instance, personnel, so people working, buildings, transportation, and IT infrastructures, such as, for instance, data centers, or just simply the computers that we use at work. And when you consider all this, for instance, the computer or the data center, and you start measuring their environmental footprint, you have to take three aspects in consideration, which are the three phases of their life cycle. The first phase is the production, the second is use, and the third is end of life. So if you consider any digital device, actually what is most costly from an environmental point of view is the production phase. So whatever you do, the production is the one phase that will have the most damaging impacts. And then you have the use phase, in which you have to take into account not just the device itself, but also the electricity that you're going to need to make it work. And then comes the phase of the end of life. And right now we don't have reasonable recycling schemes for all of these digital devices. So you see that at every level, at every phase, when you consider the digital devices, it's really like, there's no way I can do this right. and this can be somehow measured. So when it comes to production, you can gain concrete information on the impact of the production of your device on biodiversity, on water resources, etc. For the use phase, you can measure the electricity that you'll be using. And for the end of life, it's more complicated to really know what the impact is. But what is sure is that archive, publishing houses, libraries, all have these items come into the equation: personal buildings, transportation, IT devices, infrastructure, but with different ways of combining them. The general idea is that if they want to reduce their environmental footprint, they will have to reduce their activity, because that's the only way to reduce any of these budget posts, basically. And the difficulty is that nowadays the tendency is still one of growth and development. So for instance, funding schemes for research projects or even for library projects are usually based on innovation and on the ideas that you have to do more and more, while achieving the reduction of the environmental footprint should instead mean fostering activity reduction, less is better, and fostering the reuse of information and of infrastructure. So that's what I've tried to do with my digital scholarly edition. I've been working in the sense that my colleague Elena Pierazzo has been explaining in the following words. She said, okay, we are used to have digital scholarly editions that are haute couture, so really tailored for each text. And we have more to think in terms of prêt-à-porter, so some standardized way that is easier to share, easier to reuse. So that's really how we can move in the way we present text on digital platforms, to see how we can adapt to more frugal tools, to shared platforms, and to reuse facilitations. That means that we really need a clear shift in the prioritization, but also emphasize standardization processes that will help achieving long-term sustainability, which is also a way of rethinking the history of literature somehow in the way we are developing these schemes to archive and to publish long-term, on the long-term, these texts in the digital context. We are somehow canonizing some texts rather than others, these texts that will stay longer. And I think it's a fascinating challenge for historians of literature to consider that the technical choices that we are making now to reduce the impact of the text that we will be preserving will mean that these texts will stay longer and will still be there when the others are gone, and that we are deciding on what is staying. So basically we are selecting.
Yeah, that is such a fascinating set of decisions to realize the impact of, and it's making me think about all the various proprietary software I've had to download on my computer to read things from different publishers who have all created their own strange e-reader platforms. And if my device no longer supports their program, then I have to upgrade, you know. So it's like this And they don't think about what they're doing. They are exercising a certain kind of power and authority, but they don't think about what they're doing to the longevity of that work, which is, or maybe they do. Also interesting. Also an interesting thing to realize. So then you discuss in the last part of this book how environmental issues can transform text dissemination, specifically through the example of this book. And I was so fascinated by the way you listed all of the decisions that you made. They really made me reconsider decisions I am making about a current project that will only live digitally. And I would love if you could explain some of those decisions and how they were influenced by environmental impact.
So my idea with this book was to transition to a more environmentally friendly way of doing my job as a researcher and as a teacher also. So yeah, I decided to reflect on the production of the book itself as a way to engage in this transition somehow. And there the choice of the publisher was really essential. So Open Book Publishers gave me the possibility to provide a LaTeX file. So that's not the Office suite. They also offer long-time archiving and long-time accessibility through a distributed network of long-established libraries. And they do that in a stable and not resource-intensive format, which is XMLTI. So basically, my book is online, and you can order print on demand. So the copies are published on the fly, basically. And the other thing that Open Book Publishers provides is an excellent aggregation performance through the metadata. So they're in meta catalogs, and most of their work deals with that or has to do with that. And that's really in the spirit of reusable and distributed infrastructures that are needed to reduce the environmental footprint. So while I was working on the book too, I try to think about my own way of working. And there was first the simple ways of limiting my emissions, for instance. So I've avoided flying since 2019. So I'm not flying. That's one first way. And working with the book, I also avoided printing. I avoided working online. I avoided transferring data when it was not necessary. So these are really minimal things. It's not impacting too much, but it still makes a difference when you are doing that consciously, basically. Then I really made the effort of analyzing my work, all of my work steps, and see how I could measure the impact and reduce it. But my idea was also not to become too obsessive. So the goal was not to have a fully disruptive approach and do everything differently. But the idea was more, okay, how can I actually adapt my current practice? Because I've been doing my scholarly work this way for 25 years. I'm not going to do everything differently from one day to the next, to be in a more adaptive perspective. So my general conclusion after really measuring every single step of producing the book and seeing what would have to be taken into account. Again, all of these transportation and buildings I've been working on and IT infrastructure I've been relying on. My conclusion is that actually it is possible to do it. And the effort is quite minimal compared to the general gain, in the sense that you become more aware of what is superfluous in the way you work on a daily basis. And what I must say also that I was really afraid that it would be a bit suicidal somehow in terms of scholarly visibility. But actually, in the classic sense of scholarly visibility, my citation index is still up, so all is good.
That's terrific. Yeah. And I was also just thinking about the descriptions you made of just like the kind of digital files you worked with and being conscious of not using a lot of footnotes and not including images, which as you described was actually very difficult. Like it would have been easier to communicate some things with images. It made me think a lot about those simple choices we make and how we communicate our scholarship and what impacts that has outside of what we usually think about.
Yeah, well, also it's this idea with also that, you know, in the end, text will be more permanent than image because it's more frugal as a digital format. So that was really a choice for longevity.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, I've taken a lot of your time, but before we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to share about this book that I didn't think to ask about, or anything you'd like to share about new projects that you're working on now that you've wrapped up this book?
So one thing I would like to do is to thank my copy editor, because I came to her as a non-native speaker and I said, okay, Elizabeth, I really want to make this book accessible for anybody, not just scholars. And it's been a huge amount of work for her to transform my manuscripts from this non-native manuscript to something that is so easy to read. And so really it has really... Well, I like it. She has done a lot to it. So her name is Elizabeth Rankin. And I really, really would like to thank her here. And also the process of writing the book, the process of publishing the book and having published the book has been also for me a process to become aware that changing my scholarly practices is actually not enough. There are limits to what can be done at an individual level, be it in the scholarly context or in any other context, actually also in the private, in my everyday life. Discussing this question of text dissemination, you look at something that has a global impact, that has dissemination schemes that go all over the planet, and you realize that with your individual efforts, you will have very limited leverage. So my personal takeaway from the book is that adaptation is good, and I've been trying to show how to do that, but that will not suffice. And if we want to actually bring growth to a halt and really reduce human-made environmental harm, it needs much more disruptive methods than that. So right now, there are two dimensions of what I do, and I think keeping with the scholarly work on this topic is very, very important. So working on these training schemes to reduce impact in research and heritage, it really has become really the core of my scholarly activity, but also I've turned to activism to act on a more general level, more general social level, because I have the feeling that I get very different leverage. And my personal point of view on that is that both aspects are actually essential if I want to be coherent as a scholar.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. Well, once again, today I've been speaking with Anne Bayot, author of From Handwriting to Footprinting, Text and Heritage in the Age of Climate Crisis. My name is Jen Hoyer, and you're listening to New Books Network.